The man who had received the 5 talents went at once and put his money to work and gained 5 more. So also the one with 2 talents gained 2 more. But the man who had received the 1 talent went off, dug a hole in the ground and hid his master's money. After a long time, the master of those servants returned and settled accounts with them. The man who had received the 5 talents brought the other 5. Master, he said, you entrusted me with 5 talents. See, I've gained 5 more. His master replied, well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Come and share your master's happiness. The man with 2 talents also came. Master, he said, you entrusted me with 2 talents. See, I've gained 2 more. His master replied, well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Come and share your master's happiness. Then the man who had received the 1 talent came. Master, he said, I knew you're a hard man, harvesting where you've not sown and gathering what you've not scattered, seed. So I was afraid, and I went out and hid your talent in the ground. See, here is what belongs to you. His master replied, you wicked, lazy servant. So you knew I harvest where I've not sown and gather where I've not scattered seed. Well, then you should have put my money on deposit with the bankers, so that when I returned I would have received it back with interest. Take the talent from him and give it to the one who has 10 talents. For everyone who has will be given more, and he will have an abundance. Whoever does not have, even what he has will be taken from him. And throw that worthless servant outside into the darkness where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth.
That's always a great line to stand up in response to, is it? Oh, good afternoon and welcome. Now, I became a Christian when I was at university, so probably about 19, 20 years old. And I remember not long afterwards getting baptised. This is a good thing and appropriate to do. And there were a number of us got baptised that day. And one of them was a guy, to my shame, I can't remember his name, but he was in his mid-50s. I remember it was a window cleaner, and to church with him for the next couple of years or so. I can't remember his name, which I feel very bad about. But I remember we were about to be baptised and saying, oh, this is great, become a Christian, yeah, become a Christian, and we were going to share something of that publicly. But after the event, he said, now one thing I do need to say to you, I really envy you. Look, I'm thrilled, I'm delighted, age mid-50s, that I've become a Christian. But I regret that I have done so late in my life. I envy you your youth. You've got the rest of your life to serve Jesus. I've got another 20-odd years. Young man, don't waste it. It's one of those conversations you just kind of remember. Because, oh, okay, yeah, I don't know, okay, fine, super. Whether I have or I haven't, I don't know. I'm not sure I want to see him again. If he ever asked me how did you make use of your time, oh, I had a go. But there we go on. And Jesus, in one sense, is telling this story to make sure we don't waste life. Whether there is another 50 or 20 or somewhere in between years to go, don't waste your life, really. We're in this still this one sermon that Jesus gave, Matthew 24 to 25, one long talk, just to his disciples, not for public consumption, this one. And really the last thing he wants to sort of really bang away at them with is, look, I am coming back, and you need to be ready for that. So keep watch. And we've seen it in a number of stories he's told, the faithful steward, keep watch by diligently serving. Keep watch, the 10 bridesmaids last time by being prepared, there may be some delay until I come back again. And here, keep watch. Keep watch, essentially, this parable, by maximizing the assets that Jesus has given you. Doing everything you can with the resources you've got to grow his kingdom. That's really the point of this story. 3 things, they're not memorable, but hopefully they do explain what's going on. First thing, Christians are saved to serve. Then we're faithful to Jesus by growing his assets, but we don't know Jesus if we think he's demanding. 3 things there. First, Christians are saved to serve, verses 14 and 15. The kingdom of heaven will be like a man going on a journey, called his servants and entrusted his property to them. Jesus compares himself to a master and his followers to servants. Actually, they've been a little bit polite here. It's literally slaves. There's a perfectly good word in the New Testament for servants. It's not that word. It's the slave word. That's quite humbling if you're a Christian. Jesus is master. We're slaves because we were owned, well, by our sin, and now he's saved us from that for a future in glory, but we're his. We belong to him. One says that's very humbling, but at the same time, ennobling. We're slaves with significance. Because verse 15 to 1, he gives 5 talents to another, 2 talents to another, 1 talent. Now that isn't, as you probably know, Britain's Got Talent sort of talents. To one he gave the art of tap dancing, another the art of singing badly, or whatever it may be. It's a unit of money. 10,000 denarii equaled 1 talent back then. If you want some idea of the figure, another story Jesus tells, Matthew chapter 20, 1 denarius is viewed as a good day's wage for a manual labourer. So 10,000 days wages. Well, I think if you run with the average UK wage here of around 26k, Jesus is saying he gave a talent that's probably around £1 million, give or take. Many here will be on a little bit more than the national wage, I would imagine. But let's round them up then and say, so Jesus gave to one £10 million, to another £4 million, to another £2 million. That's not small change to me. Probably not to anyone, small change here. This is, on one hand, very humbling. Jesus says, you're my slaves, if you're a Christian. On the other hand, very ennobling. What I give you in this life is real, significant responsibility. I'm not mucking about. Jesus doesn't treat us like little children. You know, in our family, every so often, say the 9-year-old in our family would say, don't forget, I've got to fill in this letter, I'm going on a school trip to the theatre, and we all have to take in £5. £5? Right, quick, sort of put it in a bag, in a wallet, and Velcro it to your bag, and sellotape it to your body, because £5, you're bound to lose it. It's bound to sort of slip away. You'll spend it on sweets or something ridiculous and never make it to the theatre. We don't trust children with amounts of money. Jesus says, no, I give significant responsibility to my followers. The gifts, the brains, the opportunities, the resources, the money, the relationships, the time that Jesus gives us. They're not small things. They're significant. So Christians are saved to serve Jesus in this life. Saved from sin for service. Because we need to get that the right way round. When I grew up, small village in rural Essex, and one of my good friends was clearly wealthier than I was. He belonged, I worked out after a while, no great concept of money, but he had a wealthy family. They had a swimming pool and a tennis court, and in our village that made you incredibly rich, and the toys in their household were amazing. I mean, that's really the marker when you're about 7 years old, isn't it? The toys people have got. But I was also conscious their holidays were sensational. Well, this is going back a few years, and I didn't go overseas on holiday till I was 14. For me, exotic was Cornwall. They had palm trees in Cornwall, although they turned out, of course, to be cabbage trees, which is always a bit disappointing when you work that out. But that was exotic, whereas this family had a home in Italy and in Switzerland, where they went something called skiing. This was just exceptional in our village. They were the wealthy family. It was fine, we grew up with them. There were some benefits to being friends with their son. The swimming pool, mainly. But when I was about 7 or 8, I can't quite remember, they adopted a young girl into their family of a similar age. Now that was very striking to me. Never heard of anything, adoption was all very new. You can do that, can you? Okay. And we found out, no one really knew who her father was. Her mum was chaotic and unable to look after a child. And so eventually, after years from children's home to foster care, back to children's home, she was adopted. Now, this is just appalling to admit, but, you know, as a 7-8-year-old who's obsessed with toys and such things, I looked upon this and thought, I'd quite like to be adopted into their family. There are enormous benefits of being part of their family. They seem to have a bit more than my family. I
never confessed that to my parents, and probably wouldn't do so even now. It'd be slightly embarrassing to tell them that. But it is a bit embarrassing. But I observed her in her life. She arrived at our school, there's only one school in the village, and she was useless, rubbish. I mean, she'd been in and out of the children's home, barely had any education. She was a duffer in the classroom. But slowly, 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 she started to catch up and went to a decent secondary school and worked hard and got A-levels and went to university, became a vet and ran her own practice and has done very well, last I heard. But I remember, again, this is terrible, I remember probably about a year or 2 years after she'd arrived saying, Nicola, why do you bother working in school? You are really wealthy. You don't need to ever do any work. You're loaded. Whatever you do in life, you can go skiing and all sorts of things. I'm 9 or 10, forget, I mean, it's terrible, isn't it, really? But I remember her vividly saying, oh yeah, I've been given a wonderful opportunity. I have a family. They love me. And they've told me so many times I now get it, that they'll love me whatever I do. But I really want to work. I really want to make the best use, the best grasp hold of this opportunity. Yeah, I want to make them proud. But I know if I don't ever get any exams or A-levels or anything, they'll still love me. But I really want to work. Now, look, I only tell that story to make a simple point in one sense. She was adopted by this family and then said, I want to make the most use of this. Her labours at school did not get her into the family. She was, if you can put it in these terms, saved from a pretty miserable childhood by this family. Being saved, she wanted to, well, make the most of it. Use the resources of a family such as that. But not the other way round. Academics didn't get her into the family. And that's really important when you come to a parable such as this. Otherwise you can think it, Jesus is not saying, work hard in this life and he'll accept you. This is one, he's telling this story to those who are his, who are Christians, and saying, now I've saved you from your sin, I'm giving you the additional benefit, privilege, of having a really useful life. But it's got to be that way around. Saved from sin, then in order to serve him. It's not that our service can ever mean that we're saved. Now the other thing before we move on here, verse 15, do you notice that the talents vary? So one gets five, one gets two, one gets one. For any Christian, the call to salvation is equal, but the call to service is varied. We are not all given the same opportunities in life. There's just realism there. Even in the 21st century, you could grow up in the UK, in a Christian family, which is stable, have an education, go to university, and you leave university and the range of opportunities available to you are myriad. Many different directions you can go to serve Jesus and all sorts of resources to do so. Whereas by contrast, if you grow up as a child in northern Iraq at the moment, where the children of believers are being beheaded in front of their families, to demonstrate you don't want to follow Jesus Christ. The opportunities to serve Jesus are obviously more limited. Now that is a very stark distinction. But do you see, not all have the same abilities, opportunities to serve Jesus. We're not all given the same amount of talents. That doesn't matter, as we'll see in a moment. What matters is what we do with it. Christians are saved to serve. Some will be given enormous resources, and the Lord expects quite a lot of them. Others, not so much. You just do what you can. But Christians are saved to serve. Okay, let's get to the guts of things here. Second little thing, verses 16 to 23. We're faithful to Jesus by growing his assets. We'll focus here on, let's call them Mr. 5 and Mr. 2. They are full of action. So verse 16. The man who had received the 5 talents went at once. Actually, it's the first word in the Greek. At once, this man got up and did something. 3 things he did. He went. He put his money to work. He gained 5 more. we'll see in a moment, the other one, Mr. One, three different activities. He went off, he dug, he hid. But this Mr. Five, full of action, full of activity, putting the money to work, taking some risk, putting some effort in. Now, some here have started companies, run companies. I think you'd probably observe that is not without risk. You take a risk when you go out on your own and leave an employer. It doesn't matter how much capital you've got behind you, how wonderful the product is you're selling, how multiple your contacts and your database is, it's still risky. I don't know anyone who started a company and seen it grow without a lot of hard work and without a few moments of, oops, really? It was a bit better back then when I was safely employed. It's risky. And Jesus here, in one sense, is commending activity and having a go. Take the five and have a go. Who knows what will happen? There's no guarantees you make more. But risk, activity, diligence, that's what he's commending here. Now, what does it mean, verse 16, that the man gained five more? Well, you don't want to push the details of a parable too hard. I mean, the main point is be busy, be active, make the most use of what Jesus has given you. But I wonder, you get the same verb in chapter 18. If a Christian brother or sister is drifting away from the faith and you pull them back, Jesus says you gain them. If you explain the Christian message to someone, they become a Christian, you gain them. So it must at least mean using the resources Jesus has given us in order to build Christians up, in order to tell people who aren't believers about Jesus Christ. I'd imagine that's a part of what he means here. But the task Jesus gives to his followers here and now is to take the resources he's given, work hard with them, take risks with them, maximize their return. So take risks. With money to grow the kingdom of God, it always feels a bit risky. You think, I could give money to this organization, which is, well, but then I wouldn't have so much, and what happens if? Oh, it's always risky. But do that, says Jesus, take a risk in order to maximize the return on what he's lent you. Take risks with time. I could get out and meet that guy for lunch and, that would be an encouragement to that Christian. Or I could have lunch with this guy or this woman in my office. She said she wanted to know a bit more about why I'm a Christian. I could do, but, I'm quite busy and others would notice I'm having a lunch. And, oh, I have a risk. Make the best use. Those opportunities are scarce. Work's never scarce. There's always more of work. Make the best use of the opportunities Jesus has given. Verse 19, the master returns eventually in this story. It's a long time later. Verse 19, after a long time, the master of those servants returned and settled accounts with them. The man who received the five talents brought the other five. Master, you've entrusted me with five talents. See, I've gained five more. Super. His master replied, well done, good and faithful servant. You've been faithful with a few things. I'll put you in charge of many things. Come and share your master's happiness. Jesus will return and say, what did you do with the assets I gave you? With the time you had? With the money you had? With the contacts you had? With the opportunities you had? What did you do with them? And this day, an award ceremony? That'd be pretty fabulous, won't it? I mean, you surpass anything any of us have ever seen, better than an Oscar dinner. Better than someone, getting ennobled in the House of Lords. That's quite a good deal. It's quite a good do, isn't it? I imagine something like that. Going to the Oscars, quite a good do. I mean, obviously you cry when you get your reward. That's what you sort of de rigueur, isn't it? But I imagine you get a good lunch and a good party bag. But that's not. That's a sort of stale cheese sandwich behind the sofa compared to this award ceremony before Jesus Christ. Two things in particular are the rewards. And they're interesting ones, aren't they? Verse 23. I'll put you in charge of many things. Come and share your master's happiness. There'll be a reward in heaven. It'll be stuff. Physical. Interesting. And happiness. delight. I mean, I think we can get the latter more easily, happiness, delight, but stuff?
It's interesting, isn't it?
Probably not best to see it as, you know, an end-of-year bonus or in those sort of terms. I always found it helpful where C.S. Lewis gives a little illustration about rewards in heaven. You imagine it this way. A man marries a woman because she's wealthy. He doesn't like her. He just wants her cash. We say, no, that's wrong. That's immoral. But a man marries a woman because he loves her. He just wants more time with her. Wants to share his life with her. We say, oh, that's right. That's good. And just so we're thinking of being rewarded in heaven, it's not just tacked on. It's not a mercenary thing. But if the reward is more of knowing Jesus, serving him, that's entirely appropriate and hugely enjoyable. And that, I think, is what he's pointing to here. But it's very striking also. So that's the man with five talents. But do notice the man with two talents gets precisely the same response. Verse 23, well done, good and faithful servant. You've been faithful with a few things. I'll put you in charge of many things. Come and share your master's happiness. At the end of our lives, the issue is not the quantity of our achievements. It's the quality of them that Jesus cares about. Some people will be given enormous abilities and opportunities in this world, others far less. In the life to come, there'll be Billy Graham, as a sort of well-known sort of name, who preached to hundreds of thousands, saw tens of thousands become Christians under his ministry. And there'll be Betty Small, who lives in Little Piddle in the Whittle, a village of 20 people, and she told all 20 of them about Jesus, and one of them became a Christian. And Jesus will say to them on that final day, well done, Billy, and well done, Betty. Because you both took the opportunities I gave you, and both of you used them. Well done, good and faithful servants. Come and share your master's happiness. You see, they get the same reward in heaven. Because the issue is not what you achieve, it's whether you're faithful with what you're given. Here in this parable, it's not the quantity of our achievements for Jesus, but the quality of what we do with what he gives us. We're faithful to Jesus by growing his assets. Briefly though, this last servant, Mr. One. Oh dear, Mr. One. Verse 24. We don't know Jesus if we think he's demanding. Verse 24. The man who received the one talent came, Master, I knew that you're a hard man, harvesting where you've not sown, gathering where you've not scattered. So I was afraid and went and hid your talent in the ground. You see what he accuses his master of? Being hard. Some sort of unscrupulous capitalist, trying to reap where he's not sown. This man says to the master, yeah, I haven't done very much and it's your fault. You're too demanding. You ask too much. I was paralyzed by fear of you. And that's his big mistake. He's never understood who the master is. Never understood that he's in relationship with the master already. And serving him is a privilege. And that the master's generous. Oh, in sort of biblical categories, he's never understood grace. That Jesus saves us on the basis of what he does. And only when we're saved does he say, now go and serve me and enjoy doing it. Nicola, who I grew up with, was not paralyzed by fear of what her adopted parents would think. She knew she was safe. She knew it was their actions that had brought her into the family and nothing could change that. And so she went, yeah, I'll try. I'll have a go at doing A-levels. Oh, amazing. And I've got into university. Oh, great. And oh, actually, I'm quite clever. Isn't that fun? But no matter what she did, her family would always love her. She understood that. This man thinks his efforts get him in. That's his mistake. He thinks it's his service that saves him. Rather than only when you're saved as a Christian does Jesus say, yeah, go and serve. And fear paralyzes him. If you read this parable And you fear, what will happen at the end of my life? What will happen? What will Jesus say to me? If you fear, you don't know him. You haven't understood him. The Christian reads this and thinks, I'm saved by Jesus. And on top of that, he gives me work to do in this world. What a privilege. I'll do everything I can for him. Oh, I really look forward to well done, good and faithful servant. I'll drop a few balls along the way. But that doesn't matter because I know he'll still accept me. That's because of what he's done. But I'll give it a go to serve him here and now. So Jesus says to this Mr. One, oh look, even by your own logic, you're in trouble. Verse 26, wicked, lazy servant, so, and he quotes his own words back at him. Verse 27, well then, you could have at least put the money in the bank and gained some rate of interest. It may have been 1% or something pitiful, or even less than that in 2014, but you'd have gained something from it, at least. Even by your own logic, what you've done is terrible. You're not a follower of mine, and so he's thrown out. Don't be too thrown by the language at the end. The New Testament expectation is always that when you become a Christian, you change. There's never an example in the New Testament of someone who is genuinely a Christian and fails to change. So we're given the sort of paradigms of a Levi becomes a Christian, radically changes how he uses his life and his money. Or a Zacchaeus becomes a Christian, radically changes how he uses his life and his money. That's the model. But Jesus tells this story to say, look, if you're a Christian, you're a slave of a wonderful master. He saved you. And now says, oh, look, I've given you all these assets in this life. Make the most of them to grow my kingdom. Have fun doing that. It's an adventure. Don't view it as a burden. View it as an adventure and look forward to the reward. Activity now, rewarded with many things. Joy in the future. But if you read this and, oh, you know, will I ever get in? Will I ever get in? You've misunderstood him. Because Jesus is one who saves and only then says, serve me. But at the end of our lives, we'll be absolutely thrilled that we did. Let me lead us in prayer. Our Father, that Jesus tells us over and over again stories of what happens when he'll return and how we can prepare for his return. Clearly it's something that we're in danger of getting wrong. Clearly it's something that we need to hear repeatedly. So would we hear you? Would we be those who are delighted to know that Jesus can save us for eternity? That's on the basis of his work. And knowing that, once we're clear on that, if we're Christians here today, would we be delighted to give our lives, the resources, the opportunities, the assets we have to serve him, knowing that in heaven we'll be thrilled and delighted that that's how we've lived our lives. Amen.